This is Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call. We will continue with our conversation between journalist Chris Hedges and Abby Martin, followed by Press TV's Roshan Mohammed Salih, addressing the issue of the possible plans for a new war on Hezbollah engineered by the State of Israel. Then author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates discusses his new book titled We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. We end with well-known anti-racist lecturer Tim Wise, talking about race and whiteness in the era of Trumpism.
You mentioned that 80% of evangelicals voted for Trump. I wanted you to briefly talk about how evangelicals became this highly politicized force, because they don't comprise that much of the population.
It was really a kind of fascinating story. It was a conscious attempt on the part of right-wing groups to politicize Christian, conservative Christian movements, because traditionally fundamentalists, for instance, and evangelicals hated each other. I mean, fundamentalists considered evangelicals, because they spoke in tongues and stuff, Satan were. I mean, there were all these divisions. Mm-hmm. Fundamentalists called on believers to remove themselves from the political process and not be contaminated by it. I'm going back to the 20s and 30s. And what you saw roughly around 1980 was the rise of what we call dominionism. It was propagated by Roussas Rishduni, who wrote this very turgid book I had to read based on the Ten Commandments. But, I mean, this goes back to, we don't have to worry about prisons because all murderers will be put to death and women who commit adultery will be stoned. I mean, it's really crude stuff. And that got very heavily funded. They took over seminaries like Southern Baptist, which used to be a great seminary. They pushed out, used to have in the Southern Baptist Church a fusion of kind of conservative Christians in terms of their personal piety, but they were very left-wing in terms of their politics, which is how my father was, actually. Mm. And that's all gone. And so there was a kind of hostile takeover. The essence was, can we create the Christian society? And that viewpoint got infused into a movement that, while it's called the Christian right, really doesn't bear any resemblance to what had come before in terms of evangelicalism or fundamentalism. It was a new entity. Many people call it dominionism. And that's when it got political. And it began to strive for political power. With a lot of mistakes at first. I mean, they were too heavy-handed. They were too obtuse. Pat Robertson ran for president and this kind of stuff. And now they've gotten a lot more clever. And they allied, for instance, with the Federalist Society, so that, like, Liberty University has a law school. I mean, they're producing these Federalist judges. So they have quite effectively seeped into the inner workings of power. And it is an ideology that is, in that sense, although they speak about tradition, is really new.
And Mike Pence, he was told by Trump's people that he would be running foreign and domestic policy. He will be the most powerful Christian evangelical, if I'm not mistaken, ever in political history, especially with the executive power that's given to the presidency. Will this move us forward to what you call Christianized fascism? And if so, what would that look like?
Yes, that's what I expect, because this is an ethics-free administration, as we've seen. There's not even a pretense about ethical rules, whether it's with Trump or anyone else. And so you have what's going to become a kind of naked kleptocracy. And I'm not just speaking about Trump's family, which, of course, will get fabulously rich, but about all of those forces that are predatory, sucking money out of the education department, or they're going to loot the country. But they're also inept, which is a very bad combination. And as that ineptitude becomes more, is more pronounced and more understood, they are going to have to become more ideologically rigid. And I think the only place they're going to go is the Christian right. So what is it going to look like? It's going to look like a Christianized fascism. It's going to be the fusion of the American flag with the Christian cross and the Pledge of Allegiance. We've already seen it. It is going to be assaults on women, women's rights. It's going to be assaults against the educational system. So we're teaching creationism and magical thinking. It's going to be attacks against, quote unquote, those forces of secular humanism that are destroying the country. It's going to be a kind of sanctification of law and order and imperial adventurism into a kind of crusade. And I think that as society unravels, they will stoke this demonization of the other, Muslims, undocumented workers, African Americans are on the list, feminists, all the way down, to vent the frustration and the rage against segments of the society that are vulnerable within the context of a kind of Christianized language.
Betsy DeVos, you mentioned her. She's being roundly condemned for many reasons as being Trump's appointed Secretary of Education, but people are underreporting her ties to Eric Prince, which is her brother. He's the famous mercenary founder of Blackwater. He's also one of Pence's biggest donors, and now he's advising Trump.
Right. And as Jeremy, I had a conversation once with Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the great book on Blackwater, and I had been going around the country speaking about the Christian right. And I said, well, you don't have to worry. They're not fascists because they don't have an armed wing. Every fascist group's armed. And Jeremy said, what do you mean? That is their armed wing. And I realized, oh, he's right, and I was wrong. And they do have, through Blackwater, essentially mercenary forces at their disposal. And any totalitarian or even authoritarian government relies heavily on vigilante violence because they're not held accountable for it. I mean, even the excesses of the brown shirts, people forget Hitler would denounce it because he could. Mm-hmm. But I mean, of course, he was giving a green light to it. But then they would go beat up a bunch of people and there'd be an outcry and Hitler would say, well, they shouldn't have done that. You know, these forces will, I think, play an increasingly prominent and frightening role within American society because they're not going to be punished, they're not held accountable, and they can carry out forms of coercion and violence and intimidation and threats on behalf of the state, and the state will protect them, but they're kind of immune. Now, that's classic.
Yeah, we saw in Israel, we see it everywhere with these kind of militias that then become part of the state.
I saw it in Yugoslavia.
Yeah, but I was going to say, I mean, Blackwater and what Eric Prince is doing is almost, that is kind of institutionalized, whereas as far as the vigilante groups on the ground, the actual armed militias that are emboldened by people like Joe Arpaio and who are taking action on their own terms at the border, and those are different, right?
They are, but they'll be brought under control. Again, you can go back. I mean, the state want centralized control. That's what finally did in the brown shirts with the Knight of the Long Knives when he got rid of Rome and the SS. The SS supplanted the brown shirts. They want control. So I think all of those groups, if we come to this, will be put within structures that may not be public structures, but we put within structures.
I think a fascinating example of kind of how this has already happened under the Obama administration is the difference between the Standing Rock, North Dakota Access Pipeline protesters who are unarmed, right, and crushed, and then you have the Bundy Ranch militia.
Well, there you go. Imagine if Bundy and all those guys were black. They'd all be dead. There's a good example. But that's always been true, and Hofstadter wrote about that in his last book on violence. Throughout American history, we have relied on white vigilante thugs to go after African Americans, Chinese, labor movement. We had the bloodiest labor wars in U.S. history. Hundreds of American workers were killed. And who killed them? Gun thugs, Pinkertons, Baldwin Felts, mine militias raised by the Scrantons in Pennsylvania. There's a long tradition of that, including the Klan. And we have a kind of historical precedence for what's coming.
Mm-hmm. And as the Trump administration uses the rhetoric of alternative facts to basically shut down any dissent, what about the alternative facts being promoted from websites like Breitbart and InfoWars? Do you have any comment on the fact that Steve Bannon is now in the ear of Trump, and so is Alex Jones?
Well, they're conspiracy theorists just like Trump, so they just reinforce his kind of loony worldview.
The U.S. isn't the only country where we're seeing this far-right rise. Obviously, this is happening in Europe and beyond. How is what we're witnessing here connected to elsewhere in the world?
Well, it's the result of neoliberal economics, where you destroy public institutions. I mean, whatever you say about communism, and I was there in Eastern Europe, they had a first-class educational system, which people did not pay for. Everyone had health insurance. There was full employment. And so neoliberalism went in and destroyed, in the name of the free market, which everyone confused with freedom, all of those institutions. Huge state enterprises closed, massive unemployment. 2 million young Poles work as baristas in Spain or somewhere. And you created a new oligarchic class by selling off state assets. This happened, of course, as well as Russia. And people, you know, finally woke up and realized they were being had. And they were being had by that quote-unquote liberal establishment in the same way that we've been had by these liberal elites on the East Coast and the West Coast. And we've seen the rise of proto-fascist movements in Hungary and Poland. We're seeing powerful proto-fascist movements in France, even Germany. And it all goes back to this idea that human society and human life should be ruled by the dictates of the global marketplace. It's an insane ideology. It's never worked anywhere in human history. But until we break the back of corporate power, we're not going to blunt the rise of these movements.
Yeah, we're in such a post-truth reality that people think that Trump is still anti-establishment because they've just learned to blame the state for all of their ills.
That's right. And when they figure out somehow that he isn't, when they get what's happening, then you will see turbocharged the hate talk and the hate crimes. That's classic.
Like you said, I mean, the police state was already put in place. It just is going to take someone like Trump to pull the lever.
Right. This was the big mistake. He has all of the tools at his disposal to, with the flick of a switch, turn this into a police state. And they were all given to him primarily by the Bush and the Obama administrations. We allowed whole segments of our population to be stripped of their rights. I'm talking about poor people of color and marginal communities, a court system where, you know, 94% never even get a trial, the system of mass incarceration, the police terror where police can use indiscriminate lethal force against unarmed. Hannah Arendt writes about this in Origins of Totalitarianism. She said, when you allow a segment of your population, she was talking about stateless, she herself was stateless in France, to be stripped of their rights. Once rights become privileges, then should unrest spread throughout the society, you have both a legal and a physical mechanism to impose that already in place to impose that on everyone else. And that's what we're seeing, that what poor people of color have been enduring in these mini police states is just instantly expanded once the rest of the population is no longer passive.
You talk about how the biggest way to fight Trump, the Christian right, the alt-right, is to revolt.
Right.
Mass resistance. What does that look like? What does that mean? And why is the Democratic Party not the vehicle for the resistance?
Well, because the Democratic Party is not going to confront the underlying ideological system of neoliberalism or corporate power, which has created the mess that, you know, we now live in. Instead of we and the opposition dealing directly with the ravages of neoliberalism and what it's done, you have a Democratic Party that blames the election result on Putin or on Comey. This is ridiculous. And it is a way to be as demagogic as Trump and a way to present alternative facts of your own. And that's very dangerous because if we don't have significant segments of the society that deal with the ideology, utopian ideology of neoliberalism that has led us to this mess and continues to offer up these alternative facts, then in essence, they're going to collude with Trump to create a form of American fascism. And they will be, in many ways, as responsible. If we don't go after those corporate forces through acts of civil disobedience, such as at Standing Rock, we don't have any other way to have our voices heard or to create resistance. Now, it's going to be ugly under a Trump administration because, and Standing Rock was ugly under Obama. Rubber bullets, concussion grenades, pepper water in sub-zero temperatures laced with pepper spray. It was ugly there, but it's going to be even uglier because there just will be no holes barred at all. And, you know, in Standing Rock, they brought in private security contractors who just come from Afghanistan and Iraq, which gets back to these kind of quasi-militias allied with the Christian right. We're just going to see a lot more of that. It's going to be fierce, but we don't. There are no institutions left that are authentically democratic, that are going to challenge these centrifugal forces that have brought us to where we are. That's only going to be done in the streets.
Thanks so much, Fan, for bringing me. It's always great to be reunited with my good friend Ta-Nehisi, and we decided to dress alike tonight.
I told her we got different shoes.
Yeah, though, so. Switch it up a little bit.
I couldn't rock the silver. Before I go that far.
So, when I got the book this summer and really didn't even know what the book was going to be about, and when I opened it, I was like, "Oh, this is like a mixtape." Of the best of, but then a remix with the pre-essays. So that really, in your love of hip-hop, like were you thinking, did you think mixtape at all?
I didn't, but I think as I write in one of those essays, I can't remember which one it is, but I'm so glad the mic works. Whoever the sound guy was that was giving trouble, thank you, whoever you are. He told me he knew
He's
what he was doing.
There.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing. He's right. We've had trouble, issues. No issues tonight. Yeah, still time to mess this up. I think, though, like, I have a buddy, and she says everybody has an art that's kind of like their first language. And for me, that's hip-hop, so I would not reject that illusion. It has a huge influence over how I write and how I think about, you know, art and writing in general. So I certainly would not reject that.
We were 8 years in power. Talk about the origin of that quote and linking it to good Negro government.
Yeah, so in 1895, there was a congressman, former congressman by the name of Thomas Miller. Thomas Miller was a congressman out of South Carolina at the end of the Civil War during the period of Reconstruction, a remarkable period in American history. Where I'm sorry, it's going to be a little long. Forgive
yep,
me.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Stick with me. I give this answer to people just, you know, Reconstruction. It's like, come on, man. I worked on this. So Miller was a congressman, a Reconstruction era congressman, and you know, he was one of the contributors to arguably the most genuine moment of multiracial democracy in this country. Brief period of 8 years following the Civil War, where you had, you know, African Americans who had been enslaved, African Americans who had been free, suddenly have access not just to the vote, but to the halls of power. You had, you know, black governors. You know, for the first time, you had black senators and you had black congressmen, one of which was Thomas Miller. And in 1895, after the country had retreated from the promise of Reconstruction and basically had, you know, reunited itself on the principle of white supremacy, the South Carolina legislature went about the business of really finishing off the process of disenfranchising black people in South Carolina. Now you have to understand what that means. In 1895, the majority of people living in South Carolina were black. So we're not even talking about minority rights. We're talking about apartheid, effectively. And that was what, you know, that was not just true in South Carolina. It was also true, say, in a state like Mississippi, for instance. I think a lot of times when we think about people being deprived of what you think about a small minority population, but really actually what you're talking about is the total destruction of democracy in any sort of form in those states. And Miller could not understand why white South Carolinians would want to do this. And he took the floor to address the Constitutional Assembly. And he said, you know, we were 8 years in power. And he didn't mean just black people. He meant, you know, this multiracial experiment that included black people. But it wasn't just black people. And he said, in that period of time, we reconstructed the state of South Carolina. There was no real public school system before those black folks offered a plantation, and those two free black folks joined in government with, you know, a sympathetic white folks that were willing to work with them. They established an entire architecture, you know, of the state. They established what would have been called a sane asylums at that time. They established what we, you know, today would call prisons. They, as he said, reconstructed the entire state. And he said, having done all of that, after giving all this to the state, why would you strip us of rights? He was dumbfounded. And Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, reporting on this, you know, many, many years later, about 50 years later, in his great book, Black Reconstruction, he maintains that Miller didn't quite understand. He didn't apprehend the true monstrosity of white supremacy. And he had this line. I was reading, you know, Black Reconstruction as I was working on this book. And he says what Miller failed to understand was the only thing white supremacists in South Carolina feared more than bad Negro government was good Negro government. The idea was, it was the very fact that they had succeeded that was the insult. And so he's making this appeal, we did well, but he doesn't get, that's the whole point. They know you did well. But the fact that you did well insults white supremacy. It makes it, you know, harder to, you know, it makes white supremacy much less tenable. And so the whole idea of disenfranchisement, you know, was, you know, and it's not to say that folks would come out and admit this, but in their heart of hearts, it's about not having to compete with certain people, you know? And so they'll say, well, you can't run with me, but really, if I don't let you compete with me, then, you know, that question is taken off the table to begin with. I think that was an incredible truth that you can see reverberating throughout African-American history and throughout American history, actually. I think it, you know, tells us a lot about the past 8 years in this country. I think there was, you know, a large number, not most, but a large number, a disturbingly large number of people in this country who feared good Negro government. I mean that not just in terms of policies passed and, the ability to actually, you know, make government work, although with the current government in power, we're now seeing how important that actually is. But it's also about comportment. You know, I always tell people, like, Barack and Michelle were like a walking advertisement, an ambassador, as you will, for the integration of black people into the most bourgeois middle-class American norms. Here you have an Ivy League educated professor, first black head of the Harvard Law Review, married to this black woman, you know, from the South Side, you know, who's also Ivy League educated, two beautiful kids, dog named Bo. I mean, this is the best we got. It's not, you know, you can't accept this. I mean, I don't know how you're going to deal with me, because if you can't take that, you know, me and you, it ain't going to work. And the fact of the matter is, you know, I think that very ordinariness, that, you know, very, you know, success at appealing to those values was actually the insult. That was what, you know, that was the thing that you know, was seen as dangerous. And I think there's a strain of that, you know, all the way through American history. I won't bore you with other examples, but that was the origin of the title.
And most people don't know that you were a history major at
Howard. I was a history major at Howard, yes. Yes, I did not graduate with a history diploma. I did not graduate at all, but I was a history major.
I find myself thinking was that we were 8 years in power. Was that a double entendre? Like, mm-hmm. we understand you're talking about Reconstruction, but then is it Obama? Is it mm-hmm. black people? Mm-hmm. Is it black writers? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who, I mean, I certainly think I have some success right. because of the
right.
Obama age, just as you repeatedly point out for yourself.
Right, right. No, I think that's true. I think there were a whole crop of black writers who were empowered by the fact of Obama. I did not think black people. I know a lot of people read the title that way, but I didn't read it that way because that's not what Thomas Miller was saying. You know, he wasn't mm-hmm. saying we as black people were, you know, because that wasn't true. He was speaking to the actual government. And I felt the same way about Obama and, you know, like it being very, you know, narrow cast. I would never say black people were in power, which implies like a kind of control over the, yeah. over the country. You know, it didn't really exist.
Do you think the symbolism of Obama is more important than the policies of Obama?
No, but I think symbolism is underrated. I think one of the ways that people criticize Barack Obama, and I have my share of critiques myself, but I think one of the things they say is, well, and I don't even think this is true, but you know, one of the things that you hear is, well, it was no substance, it was just symbolism. And I tell them symbolism is not just symbolism. If it meant something that you had an unbroken string of white male presidents, and then that ended, and we all maintain that it did. There was nobody before Barack Obama who would say that it meant nothing that a black person was never president. Nobody who would say that. Nobody who would say now that it means nothing that there's never been a woman president. Of course it means something. It means a lot. You know? So then you have to accept that when that string is broken, that must mean something too. You know? And I think the hard thing is the very, I think the problem is it doesn't mean as much as people want it to mean. But it means something. You know, it definitely means something. You know, it, you know, means that, you know, to me, you know, among other things, it means to me that if you are African-American and you're really, 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 really smart and you work really, really, really hard and you get really, really lucky, like really, like the country's falling apart and there's no one else to turn to. And they're like, we tried that already. Might be president. You might be. I mean, and that wasn't true 30 years ago. You understand? Like, I don't think, like, I was doing this event, actually, for President Frederick at his house, and Kurt Schmoke was there. Kurt Schmoke was the first elected black mayor of Baltimore. And there were a whole crop of politicians before Barack Obama who could have been Barack Obama, but it was not their time. It just wasn't their time. So you have to say something has changed. Something is clearly different, you know. It's not everything. It's not the wealth gap, you know, but it is something.
I remember during the 2008 election, This American Life was out. I think it was Pennsylvania, and they knocked on this white family's door, mm-hmm. and he said, who are you voting for? And mm-hmm. she asked her husband. She said, we're voting for the nigger.
Mm-hmm.
Probably nigger, not nigger.
Right.
But it was like, yeah, the economy, it was just such a disarray. This is who we're going to vote for.
Right.
One of the pieces that I did not read when it originally came out was about why black people don't visit Civil War sites.
Right.
And I have found myself recently thinking about maybe my own, not uncomfortability with slavery. You know, Colson Whitehead's book is great.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, I read Jubilee as a child.
Uh-huh.
We watched The Roots every Sunday and dressed up and ate fried chicken in my house with other families. Like,
clearly weren't no white people.
Right. But there's a lot of slavery in popular culture, and there's been a part of me that has thought, is it just showing black people as victims? Like, why is the slavery image the image that we see a lot? But I think what I realize that it's, we don't talk about slavery in economics,
right.
economic terms,
right.
it becomes
right.
this, the you know, the noble slave, like all slaves are good, which is
right.
why Colson's book was so good, because it showed like humanity in slavery,
right.
which
right.
I can't ever really recall. I heard Underground was good. I've never saw it
right.
on WGN, but I've challenged myself, like, okay, we can show these images, but I don't think we link it enough to capitalism
right.
and
no,
the founding
true.
Of this country, but talk about your sort of journey of you know, not just the Reconstruction, but looking at slavery and why you were visiting those sites.
You know what it is now? I think for whatever reason, there is a liberal mode of analyzing the problem of racism in this country, and that's not even the vocabulary people would use. They would use the problem of race. And there's a lot of, which I don't use that. There's a lot of talk about, like, the heart. Like, it's always, like, this kind of moral appeal, you know? Good people, racism is a cancer in the you know, American heart. You know, it's a very, I don't know, sentimentalist kind of take. And what people don't understand is, like, enslavement was big business. Like, they don't understand it that way. And I didn't understand it that way. And, you know, the book is a large part, you know, about my discovery of this. And for instance, and I've said this, so if you ever heard me speak, forgive me for repeating it, but it's a very, very important set of facts to understand. You have 4 million, roughly 4 million enslaved black people in the country at the start of the Civil War. At the time, those slaves put together were worth approximately $3 billion, okay? About $75 billion in today's dollars. $3 billion in 1860 was more than all the banks, all the factories, Nathan factories, all the shipyards, all the everything, all the productive capacity this country put together was worth less than the 4 million bodies that were enslaved in the South. If you wanted to find where the largest concentration of millionaires was in this country, it wasn't in Chicago, it wasn't in New York, it wasn't in Boston, it was in the Mississippi River Valley. 60% of our exports in 1860 were cotton. It was huge. Like, it was when people, you know, it becomes sort of cliche, but people say, well, you couldn't have America without slavery. And it sounds rhetorical. No, it's literally true. I mean, you try to extract that wealth out of the country, and you just don't have the same country. You know, you really don't. As I said, you know, in the beginning, the majority of people living in South Carolina were enslaved. Majority of people living in Mississippi were enslaved. Half the people living in Louisiana, half the people living in Georgia, nearly half the people living in Alabama. I mean, this was a huge, huge deal. And if you go and visit, if you've ever visited the Civil War battle parks, battlefields in this country, they're getting better about this. But they will struggle to explain to you why some 700,000-800,000 people died. States' rights don't do it. Right to do what exactly? You know, oh, it was different lifestyles. So 800,000 people, that's what happened? Like, you had a disagreement? I mean, these are sort of explanations that have been historically, 800,000 people died? Like, usually when you have, I mean, this is 20% of the white male military age population in the South was exterminated in the Civil War. That, like, demands some sort of powerful interest at work. And the answer to that is the economic institution of slavery and how that economic institution, you know, basically became a social institution. I try to explain this to people, you know, and forgive me, I don't want to, like, make light, you know, of slavery, but it's the best way that I can understand it. You know, like, how, like, home ownership is not just, you know, Americans have huge amounts of wealth in their homes, but if you tried to explain home ownership to an alien, you wouldn't just talk about the wealth, right? You would talk about the institution. You would talk about how they have magazines, you know, dedicated to home ownership and fixing up your home, how homeowners get together and talk about what they want to do, you know, to their homes and, you know, putting on a new extension and all the good things that homeowners talk about. You would talk about all the businesses that come out of the fact of having home ownership. You talk about our tax code. You have this big, huge conversation about all the things that come out of something that seems so small. Well, enslavement was the same thing. There were whole institutions, you know, and laws and, you know, social ideas. To be, you know, a rich person in the South was to own black people, period. It was no other thing. That was what you did. Much like when you have money, you go and buy a home. Like, that's a thing you do in America. In the South, you went and bought people. Everybody, you know, did it. And so it was a system in which folks were totally, totally enmeshed. That has nothing to do with how pure your heart is. has nothing to do with, you know, any sort of cancer in y'all. There's no real way, you know, a moral argument. I'm not saying there's no moral component to owning people. Obviously, there is. But I just think, you know, that's a way of us establishing a kind of distance from something that we find abominable, as opposed to confronting the much more disturbing truth that we would have owned people to. You know, that it says, you know, something about, like, the power of institutions and systems.
It's probably no surprise that my favorite piece of yours would be The Case of Reparations.
To the Chicago?
No, not just, no. I was glad you're on the west side, not on my turf, the south side. I think that you and I and others, we're starting to read some of the same literature at the same mm-hmm. time. Like, mm-hmm. we have the exact same mm-hmm. sources mm-hmm. in our work, scholars who've looked at home ownership and, mm-hmm. you know, my journey realizing that this is the crux, just your explanation of home ownership, right. but how home ownership, we decided, well, Woodrow Wilson decided, I learned this in Richard Rothstein's book. I've always mm-hmm. wondered, like, when did home ownership become this thing, like, mm-hmm. before FDR?
Right.
Well, Wilson thought that home ownership would prevent people, if people own property, they wouldn't revolt like they were
right.
in Russia.
Right, it was anti-communist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so all the, and America has said this is the system for wealth building, but we're going to systematically say black people are not going
right.
to be a part of this system.
Right.
And I don't think we talk about that enough.
Yeah.
And you also talk in your journey with this, going from the, you know, individual work really hard mm-hmm. and have some luck to mm-hmm. these structural forces, which makes this about race, not class. And of
yeah.
course, they're entwined, but you could be a wealthy black person and still have these same deleterious effects.
Yeah. And it's almost race as class. Because what effectively has happened is black people, you know, comprise a totally different economic class. You know, it is outside of, you know, sort of mainstream. If you're talking about, there is no comparison between, like, black middle class people and white, like, none. I mean, and none at all. I'll give you an example. If you look at the gap between unemployment, and it persists at every level between black and white. It's the same. It persists for high school dropouts, high school graduates, college dropouts, Ivy League, whatever, at every level, you know what I mean? It's persistent. You know, wealth gap, you know, is the same. It is, you know, I think about, like myself and how I grew up, right? I had two parents, you know what I mean, who worked. I lived in a neighborhood, though, that, like, you would not think somebody with two parents who worked would. And I didn't understand why at the time. You know, but it's relatively normal for quote unquote black middle class or black work to live on a totally different level and to live in a different kind of way. I think the reason why we don't talk about it, though, is because it explains too much. You know, it becomes immediately clear, you know, why things are the way they are. It's an easy answer. I mean, you look at like with the homicide, you know, rate and all these people talking about black on black crime. It's not hard to understand. You know,
it is for some people. I mean, it truly is.
If you systematically wall off a group of people, if you deprive them of resources, by law, by the way, by law, through the efforts of the public sector and the private sector, if those people have a history before even that of being deprived of wealth, you know, being plundered, as I argue, in the case for reparations, and you have extremely lax gun laws in your country, well, there'll tend to be some effects. You know, some things will, you know, come out of that. And so I think one of the problems is we discuss this as a black issue, but it's not. I mean, it's not, in other words, by which I mean, it has nothing to do with the color of my skin. You know, you say black on black as though I am doing something that no other group of people would do if you put them in the very same condition. You know, people tend to kill the people they're around. I mean, this is the regrettable truth. Most white people are killed by other white people. I mean, that's just true. So, I mean, it's not like when black people, you know, kill, they're going to, you know, get in a car and drive, you know, out to, that's not how, you know, crime and violent crime tends to happen. That's not true of any human community anywhere. And so why it would be different for black people, why you would be surprised that it's more of it for black people, given the specific conditions and specific history. I don't know. The problem is, once you see that, and once it's clear the state did this, and, you know, we can, you know, without a doubt prove that the state did it, the obvious question becomes, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, because you did do this. You clearly, I mean, it's not even debatable. You did it. You
I mean,
know?
In addition to retiring, like, let's say white-on-white crime instead of black-on-black crime,
right.
I think we should start saying white segregation
right.
as well.
I mean, seriously. Seriously.
So we're in this moment where I think maybe we're too close, but I think history is going to really judge us hard.
Yeah.
I think our grandchildren are going to be like, what the hell was
yeah.
going on?
Yeah, no, it's bad. It's bad. It's incredibly irresponsible. Incredibly irresponsible. It's bad. It's bad. No, I think you're, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I mean, what is your prediction? Like, 50 years from, I mean, how, are we going to have distance in 10 years? Is it going to be 25? Is it going to be after we're gone? Like, what?
You know, when this happens, and it has happened at other points in American history, like, there were people who knew and said it at the time that the Trail of Tears was bad. Like, people knew this was a horrible moral. People often make this excuse for people. They say, well, you know, such and such was a man of their time. Bullshit. Bullshit.
They say such and such was
a man of their time. It's bullshit. And every time there are people who know who this is wrong. You understand what I'm saying? It's always the case. And so it is not the case that, you know, say, like, you know, we're going through this effort right now, people are taken down. So it's not the case that Robert E. Lee was a man of his time. It's just not true. That's just not true. The black people he owned knew he was wrong. They were of their time, too. You know? And other people knew he was wrong. John Brown was also of his time. You know what I mean? It is never the case that they're, you know, they're just, you know what I mean, that no one knows. And we're in this moment right now. I mean, I don't know. I get this question. They say, well, Ta-Nehisi, are you saying that everybody who voted for Trump was a racist or a white supremacist or a bit? No. Well, somebody clearly thinks that.
They were okay with it, though?
Right. No, that's the thing, right? No, I don't. I don't. Any more than I think every person in Nazi Germany was a rabid anti-Semite. But that is, you know, a very low bar. An extremely low bar, because the fact of the matter is, you know, and we obviously have less excuse, you know, the obvious, you know, fact to me is that the majority of people, not the majority of people, everyone who voted with Trump had no problem with a white supremacist or a racist being president. So you might personally in your heart say you're okay with it, but you were cool giving this dude the nukes. See, that you thought that was okay. You know, you thought, you know, a dude who bragged about sexual harassment should be, you know, the most...
Sexual assault, not harassment.
Yeah, thank you. You thought a dude that bragged about sexual assault, like, should be the most powerful person in the world, arguably. You thought that was okay. You know, that to me is enough. That's damning enough. I mean, you don't need to, you know, personally, you know, be, you know, X, Y, and Z. The fact that you, and I think people are going to be like, y'all lost your minds.
Y'all lost your damn minds. Now, you're like, there's a ecology of how journalism works, and you have a lot more freedom than some other reporters.
Right.
But there are, like, some really insane debates going on in newsrooms where, like, why are we debating whether to call him a white supremacist?
I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't get it. I mean, the dude said that the judge couldn't look at his case because he's a Mexican. That's what he said. That's what he said. You know what I mean? I don't understand how this is, like, vague at all, except that it's too horrible to accept it.
It's just too horrible to accept. That some white people think that you have to own a hood in your closet, like that's
right.
the bar for racism.
Right, but that's escapism.
Yeah,
that's escapism. You know, I don't have to burn the flag for people to call me anti-American. That's not the bar for me. You know, so I think people put that bar intentionally high in order to excuse a lot of behavior.
The race and gender analysis sometimes I feel is off. Like people who no matter how you feel about the candidates, like there's no sexism in mm-hmm. Clinton's loss, mm-hmm. and there's no racism in Trump's win.
Right.
How do you factor gender in this last cycle?
I think it was huge. I think it was absolutely huge. Again, I think even if you take the fact of Hillary Clinton off the table, which you should not, again, somebody bragged about sexual assault and was elected president. That should be a disqualifier. Like, the very fact that that's not a disqualifier. Like, that's a statement. That's a huge, and that this was, by the way, consistent with other behavior. Like, so let's not make this sound like it was a one-off. You know, like, this dude don't have other people accusing. He does. He does. So I think that was a huge statement. I think, what was it, the second debate? You know, where, as far as I'm concerned, he sexually harassed
him. When he was lurking
on stage, you know what I mean? I could not act that way, and nor should I be able to, towards a woman in my workplace, you know, towards another human being, period. Somehow that was okay. You know, that is to say nothing of the crowds where, you know, somebody yells, you know, Trump that bitch, Trump that bitch. Like, that's what we're doing now? You know? So, no, it was a huge factor. It was huge. I don't think, I think the standard, and I have my own, you know, thoughts and criticisms of Hillary Clinton, but I think the standard for her obviously was not the standard for Donald Trump. Somebody was clearly being held to a higher standard. You know what I mean? And I think, I don't know. I mean, that is the essence of it. That's the essence of, you know, any sort of, you know, racism, sexism, what have you. It is that I am forgiving over here and significantly less forgiving over there. You know, that I expect, you know, a kind of morality out of, you know, one person, and then I excuse it, you know, when I see it coming from somebody else. You know, this notion, I'm sorry, I mean, I go forever on this, but, like, this notion that, like, Hillary's a liar. What is Trump, though? Like, what? And Trump's not? Like, really? No, I mean, no. So it was clear. It was clear and obvious.
I hate to be cliche and be like, oh, haters are going to hate. I don't know how you're processing this, but it seems like just in these past couple of weeks that the book has been out that there's been a different kind of criticism levied at you. And how are you processing that? Do you just, like, stay off of Twitter? I mean, you're very clear about, I didn't seek the crown, I don't wear the crown, you promote other black writers,
right.
But it's like, oh, he doesn't talk about Native Americans, he doesn't talk about this, he doesn't talk about that. How are you, I mean, do you feel a difference this time?
I actually don't, because I think it was a lot for Between the World and Me. And I think actually the amount, it might be more now. You're right. It could be more. I think it was a lot for first white president. There obviously was a lot. But Between the World and Me prepared me. And so I'm significantly less surprised. You know, I have my moments. I get pissed off. But you can't fight me. You understand what I'm saying? Like, you're not going to go do the reporting I'm going to do. You're not going to go do the research I'm going to do. You know, you're not going to spend the amount of time.
What about from academics who have a different standard? I mean, they're not journalists. An academic.
I get a lot less of that. I get a lot. Mostly what I get is quick one-offs. But I, you know, like, I, what I mean by that is, like, there's something about when you actually go do the reporting, when you actually go do the research, you feel so much better armed than somebody that's just given a reaction. They don't, like, have the guns, really. You know, we're in this moment right now, I think, where, you know, there are a number of African-American journalists, you know, like yourself, like Jelani at The New Yorker, like Nicole Hannah-Jones, and these are people who are not just, like, black writers, like, sort of saying black things, but, like, they know, they have access to a kind of knowledge that, let's just say, other people do not have and aren't really interested in. I actually think that shines through. I think that's clear. I think people understand on some level, even if they can't articulate it, the difference between, I read this and I did not like it, so I took a day and wrote 800 words, and somebody that sat with a problem, you know, and let it steep. So I don't think, I don't know, man. I'm on to the next piece. You know? I mean, I'm on to the next thing for people to complain about. So I just, I don't know. I don't know. I think having, like, I'm struggling to get this across. You just are so much better prepared for the world. Like, that stuff, people give reactions and it's ephemeral. You know, the critiques of between the world, people read Between the World and Me, and the critiques of it, I think, mostly have, you know, they're still there, but, you know, people still read the book. You know? So if I do my job right, that's what should happen. You know what I mean? And people can critique, and that's fine. That's okay. That's yeah. Okay. You know, but what I'm trying to do is create the thing that's going to sit there. You know, like I think about Baldwin, right? Nobody remembers what Eldridge Cleaver said about Baldwin. No one. Only I know that because I had to, you know, go in and, I mean, you obviously have some idea too, but only if you're, like, really trying to figure it out. Nobody remembers. Like, nobody cites that. Nobody says, yes, that was really, you know what I mean? And I'm not saying I'm at that level. I'm saying that, you know, but the process of trying to get to that level, I think, is much more substantial than sort of sitting back and, you know, taking your shots.
Welcome to all of you who are here with us this morning, and welcome to all those that are joining us via live stream. Welcome to All Saints Church. If you are new to All Saints, or if you're visiting with us this morning and would like to keep apprised of our future events and other things of interest to you here, there are green contact sheets near both doors, so please take a moment to give us your contact information. That way we can get you on our e-blast list. There's also a welcome table on the lawn where you can pick up a red welcome bag, which includes a welcome card to take with you to fill out and then return to us, or you can fill it out there on the spot. We're really, really glad you're here, and we hope that you get to know us more. Each week we put our faith into action, and this week we are working in conjunction with Bread for the World. We are joining thousands of other churches around the country in writing letters to Congress, asking them to make funding decisions that put our country and the world on track to end hunger. Congress is currently threatening to eliminate domestic programs that feed children and the elderly, and eliminate foreign aid programs at a time when famine threatens over 20 million people in Africa. We need our California senators and representatives to be champions of the most vulnerable among us. So please take a moment to stop by the action table out on the lawn and sign letters to Senator Feinstein, Senator Harris, and your member of the House. Also this week, we are collecting monetary gifts above and beyond your pledge contributions to establish an emergency fund for local individuals and families impacted by the unjust immigration enforcement and detention policies of our government. This connects us to the wider Pasadena Sanctuary Sabbath weekend at various local faith communities seeking to provide awareness and education on these issues. Finally, it is your generosity that makes the big difference here. Please consider making a pledge to All Saints Church so we continue to spread justice and healing in the community, nation, and our world. Now, it is my great honor and pleasure to introduce to you Tim Wise, our speaker for this morning. And we are so delighted to have him. Tim is among the nation's most prominent anti-racism activists, educators, and writers. He has spent 25 years speaking to audiences in all 50 states, on over 1,000 college and high school campuses, at hundreds of professional and academic conferences, and to community groups across the nation just like ours. He has also lectured internationally and has trained corporate, government, law enforcement, and medical industry professionals on methods for dismantling racism in their institutions. Wise's anti-racism work traces back to his days as a college activist in the 1980s, fighting for divestment from and economic sanctions against apartheid in South Africa. After his graduation, he threw himself into social justice efforts full time. He became a community organizer in New Orleans public housing, a policy analyst for children's advocacy group focused on combating poverty and economic inequality. He served as an adjunct professor and was also an advisor to the Fisk University Race Relations Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. He is the author of 7 books, including his highly acclaimed memoir, White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son, as well as Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority, and his latest, Under the Influence, Shaming the Poor, Praising the Rich, and Sacrificing the Future of America. These books are available over here if you're interested in purchasing one. And a new update on Tim, which really interests me, he's also one of five persons, including President Barack Obama, interviewed for the video exhibition on race relations in America, featured at the newly opened National Museum of the African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Congrats. That's a huge honor. So join me in welcoming Tim Wise.
I didn't know whether to put that piece in the bio, to be perfectly honest, because it could be perceived as like, oh, there's another white guy gentrifying black space again, you know, showing up in the African-American History Museum where he doesn't really belong. So I was sort of like, no, and then they said, but the director wanted me to be in it, so I was like, I'm going to do it. And then if I get pushback, I'll point them at the director and they can take it up with Lonnie Bunch. Anyway, thank you so much for being here. It is good to be back. It's been almost exactly 1 year, I think maybe a year and maybe 2 or 3 months since I was here before. I don't know if you know, some stuff changed in the country. God, it was a weird 15 months, you know? When I was here before, I was like, you know, I remember Donald Trump had said something, and I was like, but I'm not going to dwell much on this because I don't really have to, and guess I should have dwelled on it a little more. So here's the thing I think you know about me if you've heard me speak before, if you've read my stuff. I am not known for my optimism. You know, like, I mean, I'm not an overly pessimistic person either, but I'm not known for my optimism. I'm not cynical. But I'm not known for my optimism, so what I'm about to say may seem strange. It's because I got teenagers, 15 and 13-year-old girls, and I'm trying, before they leave my home, to instill in them some hope and some optimistic outlook. So I'm trying to tease a silver lining from the incredibly dangerous storm clouds that I think we can probably most of us see and understand and feel in this country. And I don't even know if I've convinced myself of this silver lining yet, but I'm going to try it out on you. And you may not buy it either, because I don't know if I can sell it, right? But here's the thing. Like, for the last 8 years, those of us who do this work, myself very much included, we have had to go around this country and convince people that racism was still a thing. Like, for 8 years, that was sort of the subtext of our job. That was our job description. Like, no, really, it's still a thing. And we didn't have to convince people of color of this. But white folks sometimes need a little coaxing. You know, it takes us, we're sort of slow on that stuff. So we've had to be working really hard to convince white folks that these kind of discussions or, you know, this kind of stuff was even necessary. So here's the silver lining in the current situation. Yeah, I don't have to do that work anymore, right? I mean, there's something to be said. See, did I sell it, or is it just, it was sort of cynical, but like funny cynical, right? I don't really have to pull teeth anymore because I think we sort of get it now increasingly, or at least some do, not all, right? It's sort of like, and I know sports analogies are way overused, but I'm from the South, so you're going to have to indulge me for a minute. It's sort of like back in the day, and if you've always lived on the West Coast, you may not know this, but those of us who live in the Central or the Eastern time zone, on Sundays when CBS was the only network that showed NFL football, right? They had in the South, it was the noon game and the 3 game. And the 3 o'clock game would always bleed over into what? 60 minutes, right? It would bleed. Now, if you're on the West Coast, you got to see it in real time because they were starting the games at, you know, 8 o'clock or 5 in the morning or whatever they were starting them out here. But for us, the 3 o'clock game would always get over around 6:15, right? And then the announcer would break in, like a little voiceover, and they would say, "Now back to your regularly scheduled programming." That's sort of what the election of Donald Trump is, y'all, and I need you to understand it is back to your regularly scheduled programming. All this other stuff for 8 years, that was like D.L. Hughley said this better than I did. He said it's sort of like going to a Broadway show, and that's the intermission, right? And then the intermission's over, and it's like, back to the show, right? And the reason it's important for me to say this is I think in the last several months, people have been paralyzed by this fear, understandable, but a fear that is rooted at least in part in the idea that this is a really new deviation, right? That this is some new, uniquely dangerous moment in American history, right? And one of the things that I do want to say that perhaps, I don't know if it's optimistic or just trying to put things in perspective, right, is that one thing this is not is new, right? And the reason that's important to understand is if you think the monster in the room is one you've never seen before, right? You don't have any idea how to respond to it. You don't know how to fight it. It knocks you off balance precisely because you're trying so hard to just decipher what it is. But I want to suggest to you that the monster that stalks the country, which, by the way, is not a man, it's a movement. It's an ideology. It's not Trump, it's Trumpism. That there's nothing really new about it. And take heart in that, because if the monster isn't new, then our resistance doesn't have to be all that different. We just got to keep doing what folks have been doing, the very people who are chronicled in that museum that I'm honored to be a part of in that video, because they know how to fight monsters. And they've always fought monsters. And I'm fairly confident that if Bull Connor could not lay black and brown folks low, if Jim Clark in Selma could not lay black and brown folks low, if Lester Maddox in Georgia could not lay black and brown folks low, that Donald John Trump ain't going to be the one, y'all. So just know that. So let's understand Trumpism. And first, let's dispense with some of the nonsense, right? Because there are still a lot of people who would have us believe that everything I just said, however much it might be pretty rhetorically, that it isn't really fair, because after all, it's not right of me to suggest that Trumpism is first and foremost a white nationalist project. That it's not, I hadn't said that yet, but I just did. But that's not fair, Tim, because, you know, these are folks who are first and foremost motivated by their economic anxiety. Here's how we know that that isn't true. First, we know it's not true because if Trumpism were rooted mostly in economic anxiety, black and brown folks would have been lined up around the block to vote for him, right? Because when it comes to economic anxiety, people of color are the ones who always, both quantitatively and qualitatively, have a disproportionate share of it. African American folks, even who have a college degree, almost twice as likely as whites with a degree to be unemployed, regardless of major, by the way. Latino and Latina folks with a college degree, 50% more likely than whites with a degree to be out of work, regardless of major. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders with a degree, 23% more likely than whites with a degree to be out of work. Our indigenous brothers and sisters, 2/3 more likely to be unemployed even when they have a degree, relative to white folks. So if economic anxiety were the principal driver, this would have been a multicultural, multiracial movement unprecedented in the history of America. And I think it is safe to say that that is not what we saw. That isn't to say economic anxiety isn't in the picture, though. Right? See, this is the mistake we make in this country. I think sometimes when we talk about class and race as separate phenomena, that we ignore that, yes, it was about economic anxiety, but only in relation to a backdrop of white supremacy and privilege. And what I mean by that is that white identity for hundreds of years, going back to the colonial period, has been about the connection symbolically of whiteness to a form of caste superiority, even when one's class position was wanting and lacking, right? In other words, it was the way to tell even the poorest white person that you're better than even the best off person who isn't designated as white. It was what W.E.B. Du Bois would later call the psychological wage of whiteness. And that is the coin of the realm in this culture and has been for a very long time, especially if you're suffering, right? Because if you're rich, this is redundant, right? This skin, this is redundant. For Donald Trump, this is redundant, right? For Bill Gates, this is redundant. For anyone who has a whole lot of money, right? For those 38 people in this country who have the same net worth as the bottom half, because those are the numbers, by the way, this is redundant. But for the poor white Appalachian coal miner or assembly line worker in Pennsylvania, this is often all they got, and they will cash that check. Because this culture has told them that it has value. So that's our dilemma. It isn't that they don't suffer economic anxiety. It's that they suffer it, and by God, they weren't supposed to have to. Right? There's this thing called expectationalism, which I don't know if it's a thing, but it's a word. Maybe I made it up. I don't know. I like it. And one of the privileges and perks, I suppose, of being a white male is I can just make up words and get away with it. So I'm going to use that when it serves a positive function, right? Expectationalism, right? says to white folks, you are supposed to have the best of everything, but even if you don't, you'll at least always have this. So it isn't really shocking when a candidate for office would play on that. That's why I'm saying it's not new. It's not new at all. It's been around for a very long time. So it is about economic anxiety, but only against a backdrop of racial supremacy. Trumpism is predicated on a few things in particular that we've seen before. The first is, of course, nostalgia. It is first and foremost a nostalgic movement, right? That's why the hat says make America great again, right? It doesn't say let's make America great for the first time because we really haven't ever gotten it right before. Not only because that won't fit on the hat, but because the people who crafted the slogan wanted to appeal, much like the Tea Party did before them, to a nostalgic past. And I know a little something about nostalgia because, like I said, I'm from the South, and we do that with grits. Like, that is what we do, right? I mean, we had that song. You've heard the song, right? Wish I were in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. And if y'all think the South lost the Civil War, you haven't been paying attention. Right? Just telling you the truth, see? Sometimes victories take a really long time to manifest and materialize, and folks go to sleep. But that's what we do. We do nostalgia. And the whole nation under Trumpism is gripped by that, the notion that once upon a time we were great. Now, they'll never tell you when you ask them when, right? Because I do that, because I'm pushy that way and obnoxious. And I'll say, well, when, you know, when was it great? And they always are like, well, you know. Because they know any answer they give makes them sound like a jerk, right? They can't give a good answer. They can't say the 50s, because then they're going to be like, oh, yeah, wait, you know. They can't say the 1911, like, teens or something, because children are working in mines and factories. They know that sounds terrible. But you know, in a way, that's what they're thinking, right? That we want to go back to this age of supposed innocence when everything was wonderful. And so nostalgia makes up a big piece of it, and that's nothing new. The second thing Trumpism is predicated on is a backlash to real or at least perceived gains, but often real gains made by people of color. If you want to understand what's going on in this country, it's one thing to come and listen to me, and I'm glad you're here, and I'm totally going to sell you books in a minute, so that's my subliminal. I'm a slick salesman like that. I just put it out there for you. But read mine for sure, but please read Carol Anderson's book. Carol Anderson, a brilliant scholar at Emory University, who wrote this book, White Rage, that came out about a year ago, maybe 15 months ago. It's a brilliant book, because what she talks about, and she does it in like only like 148 or 172 pages or something, very quick, very brief, to the point, talking about how every single iteration of progress, specifically for black folks, but I think you can make the same analysis for peoples of color generally, every diminution of whiteness as power, every advance was met not just with the term backlash, which is almost a soft sell, right? But real rage, whether that was the rage that met the end of enslavement, right? The Reconstruction era met with intense hatred, and the resurrection of really slavery-like conditions for African-American folk throughout the South, a vicious resurgence of white supremacy culminating, of course, in Jim Crow laws. When the Great Migration takes place and you have black folks moving north to escape conditions in the South, they are met with a significant rage in the Midwest and the Northeast and the industrial corridors of this country. Overt racial pogroms, we call them race riots, but that doesn't do it justice, right? Racial pogroms, orgies of violence that meet these migrants looking for work, right? Again, some themes repeat themselves over and over in our history, as we see right now with the way that we treat migrant labor as well. White rage that met the Brown versus Board of Education decision, a kind of rage that led entire school districts to simply shut down their public schools in the South, create white flight, so-called Christian academies where the white folks could go and end black schools or black schooling after fifth grade or seventh grade or eighth grade. It was a form of real rage. We saw it culminate not only in the South, in places like Boston, right? And there were desegregation crises out here, as you well know. And so, right, West Coast, East, South, all around the country, that kind of rage which met progress. And of course, then that culminates even beyond the desegregation backlash with the response to affirmative action, the response to the Fair Housing Act, all kinds of backlash that we saw throughout the 80s. And then, of course, with the advances signified or symbolized by the presidency of Barack Obama, you get birtherism, you get the Tea Party, you get this I want my country back mentality. Putting aside how concrete the gains for black and brown folks really were in the years of the Obama administration, and we can debate that. I personally think there's a lot, of course, that was left on the table, so to speak. I don't put that on him. I put that on us and him. All of us together had to do more, didn't do enough. But the point is, it certainly was symbolic of advance. It was symbolic of progress, and it was met with the same kind of rage. And so what we're seeing with Trumpism is what we saw in the 60s and the early 70s. It's what we saw in the 1920s and the 1930s. It's what we saw in the 1890s, the 1870s, the 1880s, even some of the same rhetoric, right? The rhetoric of white victimhood, right? The idea that we're the ones now, that's what all the surveys say, white folks are locked in this not only nostalgia for the past, but this real fear that we're the ones being victimized. Not only the polls tell us that, YouTube tells us, right? Because you can get on YouTube and you can see videos of some of these folks, right? This one guy, you saw him in the Starbucks. This white man melted down in a Starbucks, yelled at a black barista, called her everything but a child of God, used every possible racial slur, pointed out, I voted for Trump, like that was at all relevant to his latte purchase, right? But he apparently got bad service and wanted to let everybody know that, by God, I'm a Trump voter and you're a, and he uses the N-word, and it's all on video. And his point was that he feels oppressed because he got bad service at the Starbucks. Y'all, if you think that bad service at the Starbucks, like they put soy milk in and you asked for 2%, like if you think that that is oppression, you have just proven white privilege with a vengeance. Better than me or my books or Carol Anderson or her books or any person of color ever possibly could. Because if you think that's oppression, you don't know what oppression is. So thank you for the assist, you know, in the pedagogical approach of what I'm trying to do. And there was the white woman in the Michaels in Chicago, right? Bought too much stuff to fit into the plastic bags that they give you. And so the black woman who was the clerk said, hey, we've got these, you know, reusable, recyclable bags. It'll just be a dollar. Your stuff will fit in there better. And she goes ballistic, starts using racial slurs at her. Again, talks about being a Trump voter like it's relevant to her crafting or whatever she was doing with the stuff from Michaels. Once again, thinking that she's oppressed because they asked her to buy a $1 bag, y'all. A $1 bag was oppression. See, this is what Robin DiAngelo talks about as white fragility, right? This idea that we're just sort of like, and it's funny because these are the people that call progressives snowflakes, right? These are the people that, those of us who fight racism, well, you're snowflakes because you can't handle what? Like, you get triggered too easily. You think everything is racism. So we're the snowflakes. This coming from people who sort of lost their mind when they redid Annie with a black character, right? These are... You know, they redid Annie with a black actress and Jamie Foxx. And it was like, you can't redo Annie. It's a classic. She's an orphan and she has red hair. You know, and then they made Rue black in The Hunger Games. And we're like, oh, no, no, no. You can't do that. So, you know, sort of interesting when you call someone a snowflake and you melt that easily. But that's sort of where white rage is. It's gotten to this absurdity, but it's always been there. It was Justice Joseph Bradley of the Supreme Court in 1883 who first coined the concept of sort of reverse discrimination against white people when he, along with his colleagues, threw out many of the Reconstruction era civil rights laws by saying that it was time for the Negro to stop being the special favorite of the law and join the rest of us as mere citizens, right? This is sort of ironic considering that up until a few years before, only whites could be citizens and were considered as such. But now all that special treatment, you know, the Freedmen's Bureau, which lasted about a minute, and the Freedmen's Bank, which lasted about another minute, was too much favoritism. So again, this stuff has been around, and I want us to remember that because folks fought that then, and we don't have to be disheartened now. It's really not a unique moment. It just goes to show that, you know, as I think we might all know, Donald Trump didn't really think of something new, right? This isn't some new stuff, right? It's a lot easier to fight the monster when you've seen him before. That's all I'm saying. The third thing that Trumpism is predicated on is this longstanding divide and conquer thing. Now, I think I probably talked about this last time I was here, and I looked at the video this morning because I don't want to repeat myself, but then Albert, my buddy, you know, he says to me, you know, Tim, when the Stones play, they still do Satisfaction. So so I was like, okay. All right. Well, I'm not Mick Jagger, and y'all ain't paying me like the Stones, but But if I did repeat this, if I am being repetitive here, it's because it's an important tune and an important note to hit, right? You know, the history of the country is the history of rich white men telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. I mean, that's America sort of in a nutshell when it comes to race and class, right? If you had to put, I don't know, it may be too many syllables for a haiku, but you know, it's like basically if you had to come up with a very short phrase that you could, I don't know, maybe too long for a bumper sticker also, but it's the history of America is the history of rich white men telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown. It begins in the colonial period, right, when whiteness wasn't even a thing yet. There was no white race. We didn't love each other. We spent most of our time in Europe killing each other. The English hated the Irish. The Irish hated them back. Northern Italians didn't consider Southern Italians to even be Italians, right? The Germans hated everyone. And the feeling was quite often mutual, right? I mean, the history of Europe was sort of the history of killing one another and looking for the witch, alternately. That was the other thing we did a lot. We didn't consider ourselves one big happy family. But all of a sudden, in the middle of the 1700s, there becomes a need for this thing called the white race. Well, what changed, right? What changed was rich folks looked around, started counting, and realized they were heavily outnumbered. When you take African enslaved folks, European indentured servants, just one level above enslavement, when you look at other peasants in the European group who maybe weren't indentured, you put them together, they outnumber the elite, right? You had a handful of folks that owned all the stuff, and everybody else working for them. See, some things really don't change. 400 years on, we're back to that, right? And so they looked around and realized they had to figure out a way to get some of those poor Europeans on their team. They create the notion of whiteness, the white race, give out little perks here and there. You can enter into contracts, testify in court. You can vote, at least if you're male. We're going to put you on the slave patrol to keep those people in line, right? It's not real power. You know, you're on the slave patrol. You don't own the land, right? You know, and this is important in an era of police misconduct in our country to understand. This is the bright line of the first iteration of law enforcement was slave patrol, right? And black and brown folks know that. See, knowing your history is really important because I gather that a lot of white Americans don't know that history that stretches from slave patrols to the present. And if you don't understand that and you don't understand the way in which black life has been discounted so regularly, then a phrase like, let alone a movement like Black Lives Matter won't make sense to you, right? And then you'll say things like, well, but what about my life? But all lives matter, don't I? But what about me? I know all lives matter, precious. I know. I got two white children. I know. You don't have to tell me that their lives matter. The problem is every police officer in America knows already. And every teacher in America knows. And every employer knows. And every bank loan officer knows that their lives matter and that their credit record probably won't. See, that's the difference. Right? But if you don't know the history, including the slave patrol history all the way up to the present, lots of misconduct in the Los Angeles area. If you don't know enough about it, just watch. I think it was episode 2 of the 5-part OJ documentary on ESPN. You'll know all you need to know about the history of the LAPD. And it'll put everything in perspective for you if you didn't already know. Right? Now, you know, could have just asked some black folks and they would have told you. Could have just asked some Latinx folks and they would have told you. But a lot of times we just don't know this stuff because we haven't been taught. Not your fault. Right, I wasn't taught it. I took AP history. That's the history for smart people. And they still didn't teach me about that. So you can't know what you weren't taught. You can't teach what you don't know. So anyway, the divide and conquer starts in the 1700s. And all of a sudden, the cross-racial rebellions that had begun to foment begin not to foment, begin to diminish, and whiteness becomes stronger. The Civil War era is the same thing. You got rich white folks telling poor white folks that they got to go out and fight because the rich don't fight. The rich aren't going to fight to keep their own property interest in other human beings. They're going to get poor people to do that. Rich people, if y'all aren't clear on this, don't fight wars. They get poor people to do the dirty work for them. They get doctors to write notes saying they have heel spurs and can't go to Vietnam. That's what rich people do. And if y'all don't know who I'm talking about, you can just Google that. That's what the internet is for, y'all. So they get these poor folks to go fight. But why would you do that if you are poor, man? I'm telling you that the reason the war needs to happen is to maintain my property interest in slaves, because you do know we were real transparent about that 150 years ago. We're embarrassed now, so we lie. Oh, it's not about that. You know, it was about some sorghum gravy recipe or something. It was states' rights, and it was just, we just wanted small government, you know, whatever. I mean, You know, Jefferson Davis threatened to shoot women in Richmond who were protesting his government. That's how much they believed in small government and the people. But, you know, that's something we say now. 150 years ago, the Southern elite were very clear that it was about white supremacy. Alexander Stephens said that was the cornerstone of the Confederate government. So we talked about it, but how do you get poor folks who don't even own a human being, right, to go out and fight? Well, you do it by telling them if you don't fight and they get their freedom, they're going to take your job. But they already had the job. That's the point, because if I got to charge you $1 a day to work on your farm and you can get that guy over there to do it for free or that woman over there to do it for free because you own them, guess who got the gig? Free got the gig. People like free, right? And so ultimately, the working class, quote unquote, white person, their labor was underbid, right, by the enslavement system. They'd have been better off sticking it out with black folks to overthrow that system. But the psychological wage of whiteness said, forget all that. Cash this check. Labor union movement, same thing. Labor union leaders, right, who aren't even the elite. They're just the elite within the labor struggle, saying things like, well, you know, we can't integrate the union. It'll reduce the professionalism of our craft. No, it will double your union. And then when y'all go out on strike, the boss can't hire the black folks, the Latinx folks, and the Asian American folks to replace you. And that's what they're going to do if you don't bring them in. They're going to replace you with the very people you thought you were better than. And then you'll get mad at who? Them, not the boss. Divide and conquer. So are we really surprised that this continues to work? Right? Are we really surprised when a politician says, we got to build this wall right here because that's why y'all don't have jobs. We build a wall, all the jobs will come back. For real? You think that's how capitalism works? You think capitalists of America are sitting around going, man, I hope they don't figure out this thing about the wall, because if they just figure out to build a wall, we're going to have to give everybody a raise. That's not how capitalism works. Capital will always jump borders in search of the highest rate of return. Goods will always cross borders in search of the highest price. If you allow capital to cross and goods to cross, but you don't let labor cross in search of the highest wage, you inherently tilt the game against working people north and south of that border. So once again, working class folks in this country, white, black, and otherwise, would be better off to have a larger and more militant working class, right? But you build that wall and you choke off the prospects of that altogether. This isn't why folks don't have work. I did get, you know, I get emails like that, though. This young man writes to me and says, I can't find a job because blacks and Mexicans are taking them all. Really? All the jobs? They're taking all of the jobs. Where exactly are they taking them, right? People of color twice as likely to be unemployed. It's like if they are taking them, they're taking them like a block, and then they're like, yeah, done with that. No. Every time I hear that, I have this image in my head of some dairy farmer in Iowa. Wakes up 4:30 in the morning, time to milk the cows, time to milk the cows. Walks out to the barn to milk the cows, looks around and goes, well, I'll be damned, these cows have already been milked. Who did that? Right? And then some black guy pops up from around the side of the barn. It's me, Andre from Detroit. I did that. I took your job. And then the farmer's like, durr. You know? I mean, it's absurd, right? But we have, I mean, the more you think about it, the more absurd it is. That's why it's sort of funny, but it's just this idea, right, that these people took my stuff. Now, of course, there are no Mexican folk that were responsible for, documented or not, that were responsible for the meltdown on Wall Street, right? But divide and conquer says we don't look at them. Divide and conquer says we look at the people at the very bottom of that system, right? Or we say things like, well, you know, Mexico's not sending their best, like England sent their best, right? Right? Like, I think it's relatively axiomatic that the best never leave, right? Like, by definition, the ones who are winning don't get on the boat, right? It's only the losers who get on the boat. Why would you get on the boat if you were winning? Why would you? You wouldn't. You would stay right where you are, right? It's only the, and there's nothing wrong, by the way, with being the loser who either gets on the boat or crosses that border. The difference is when you forget how you got here. Right? See, black folks know how they got here, and indigenous people know how they got here and were here first, and Latinx people know because they are indigenous, let us not forget, though we try to encourage them to forget. They know that they were here long before most of the rest of us were. It's only some of us from Europe that have this mythology. Well, we came for freedom, and they're coming for stuff. Yo, we came for stuff. We came for land. Even liberty is some stuff that you didn't have in the other place. But if you divide yourself from other people, right, then it's impossible to see yourself in them and to see them in you. Here's why this is not just an academic point, and then I'm going to be done and take some questions. And this is something I know I talked about last time. And Ed actually talked about it in the service before I spoke, because it had just come out in the news. But it's really especially relevant now. So you remember, if you were here last time, we talked about that research that had found this interesting and to some inexplicable spike in death rates among working class white folks, middle-aged, non-college educated white folks, disproportionately from suicide, opioid addiction, or cirrhosis of the liver brought on by heavy drinking. And it was the only subgroup between 1999 and 2013 that saw a spike in mortality, right? Black mortality continued to drop. Latinx mortality continued to drop. But this one group, right, saw this spike, 200 to 300,000 excess deaths relative to what should have happened had the other trends continued before 99. And so you start to wonder why. Why would this be the group? Well, they call these things in the paper, if you followed it, deaths of despair, right? That these are folks, especially the opioid crisis, which it's sort of odd that we call it that, right? Because there was an opioid crisis in the 70s that was disproportionately black, brown, and urban, and we didn't call it that. We called people junkies. We did not counsel rehabilitation. We threw them in prison. We did the same thing in the 80s with the crack epidemic. We didn't counsel rehab, counseling, or education, or any form of forbearance. We just locked people away. Now that it's salt of the earth white folks in small towns, my God, we must help these people. Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt to that. We're just about 40 years too late to having that empathy and compassion. But anyway, right, the interesting thing about this spiral in these deaths of despair, once again, these aren't necessarily the people in the most pain, right? And I'm not trying to minimize their pain, but again, objectively, every economic and social well-being indicator says that black and brown folks are overwhelmingly worse off. But these are folks who, because of that expectationalism that I referenced before, got to grow up in a society saying, that won't happen to me. See, if you tell folks that all you got to do is work hard and everything will work out. See, if you're a person of color, you know it's never been that simple, right? Black and brown folks know that that's a myth on a good day, right? People of color know they've worked hard all their lives, often have nothing to show for it. The only group in America that's really had the luxury of believing that myth, and not all of us have, but the only one that could have, to any real extent, have been white folks, even working class white folks. Because if I'm a working class white guy, historically, is this not true? I've always had the luxury of at least believing in horizontal mobility, which is, what is that? That's my granddaddy worked in the mine, my daddy worked in the mine, I work in the mine, my son's gonna work in the mine, right? As long as you have a strong back and can lift stuff, as the old saying goes, you'll always have work. Once again, no person of color ever took that for granted. But a lot of white folks, particularly white working class men, did. And then when all of a sudden the economy shifts under their feet, right? And the jobs are no longer there because of economic trends that they have no control over. When all of a sudden the guy that operates the coal mine figures out it's cheaper to just blow the top off the mountain with dynamite, right? That doesn't take as many workers. You don't have to get as many miners down there when you can just blow the top off the mountain and get the coal out that way. It's not environmentalists. It's not hippies that make the coal industry go away, right? It's rich white dudes who themselves never worked in a mine but own one, right? And yet, if I'm not prepared, right, if I'm not ready for setback because generally I haven't faced it, or maybe I have, but I always had the hope, right, the belief that my kids, they'll be better off than I was, just like I was better off than my folks, just like my folks were better off than my grandfolks. That trajectory held for a lot of history for the vast majority of white folks. It still holds, I would say, for most, but for this group, right, for whom it doesn't, it's like, oh, no, you told me that I was going to have a 7 or better on the scale of life if I just played by the rules, and I'm only at a 5.5, and I'm 45 years old, staring down retirement here in about 20 years. What am I going to do, right? I guess what I'm trying to say is white folks should have been listening to people of color all along, because if we had, we would have known that the system was rigged, see? We would have known that the system was a scam, that it was a fraud, that it was a hoax, and maybe then we could have joined in solidarity with people of color to change that system rather than falling for the divide and conquer, because the divide and conquer now, it's not just that it takes people away from recognizing their class interest, which obviously is no great shakes to them. They don't really think about that, right? It's not just that. It's that identifying with whiteness and the expectationalism that comes with it is literally killing folks, because they don't have the coping skills to deal with setback. It's something James Baldwin wrote about, and I did quote him last time, same quote, but I will do it again because this is satisfaction, not what I said. This is the Mick Jagger moment whenever I quote James Baldwin. This is what Baldwin said. He was writing about black folks and the ability of people of color to overcome obstacles and the inability sometimes of the dominant group to do it. He said the following. He said, "I don't mean to romanticize suffering, but that person who can never suffer can never grow up. That man who has to snatch his manhood out of the fires of human cruelty that rage to destroy it every day, learn something about himself in the process that no school and no church on earth can teach, and that is a sense of his own authority, and that is unshakable, because in order to save his life, he has to constantly figure out the meaning behind the words." When a person is constantly having to survive the worst that life can bring, they cease to be afraid of the worst that life can bring. See, folks of color ain't scared in this country right now. Are they concerned? Yes. Are they disturbed? Yes. But are they afraid? Absolutely, they are not, because they have seen this movie before, right? And they know that that movie doesn't end until we say that it ends. And if you haven't had a chance to go to that museum in D.C., please do it. It will restore you. Right? You will see the images. You will see Nat Turner's Bible. You will see Emmett Till's original casket. You will see the images of all those who came before this administration and tried to destroy the spark of liberty and freedom and justice that has always burned in black and brown folks' breasts and souls and minds, and have failed to do so. And like I said, if you come out of there and you're still worried about this moment and this man and this presidency, you need to go back through again and pay a little bit closer attention. Because at the end of the day, we're the ones who will make America great. Not again, but for the very first time. Thank you all so much for being here.
You've been listening to Wake Up Call. My name is Bernard White. Hope you enjoyed the program. Hopefully you'll be around for the next edition of Wake Up Call. But until next time, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
This place. Oh, yeah. They wanna be in this place, yeah. They live and breathe in this place. Oh, 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 oh. This place. Do-do.